There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th podcast, listeners. Rabia Chaudhry here, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host and colleague, Susan Simpson. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hey, Rabia.
I'm also very excited to introduce our new guest to our listeners, Michael Baranowski. He is an associate professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. He's also the creator and host of the Politics Guys podcast, which is a show founded on the belief that liberals and conservatives can engage in rational and civil debate. Now, you know, we actually started that way too, but we'll get back to that. As opposed to trading insults and talking points, he's also the author of Navigating the News, a Political Media User's Guide. Hi and welcome, Michael.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Thank you for coming. I mean, it's I listened to a couple of your episodes, really good stuff. And yeah, so when we started off with the 45th, and you know, we still attempt to do it every so often, we really did want to make it a balanced show. How's that been going for you? It's been a little bit tough for us at the 45th.
It can be difficult just given the nature of the current president. There are just some things that go, it seems to me, are just beyond the pale, and it can be rough. He's challenged us in so many ways, I have to say.
Yeah, that's true. We also, I mean, for our listeners also, we tend to get sometimes a strong reaction where they're like, well, we don't, that conservative view on whatever issue, it doesn't ring true. We don't want to hear it. Get rid of it. We just want to hear you guys. So that's been tough. But I do like to, there are lots of conservatives that are very thoughtful people. And it's like, you know, I really just want to hear their kind of thought process on some of these issues and what's going on. And how are they coming to terms with some of the extremes coming out of this administration? So I think it's important to have this conversation. And I hope our listeners check out your podcast so they can continue to do so. I want to start off, I don't know, Susan, if you have anything you want to start off with before we get into some of the bigger pieces, but some news came out of the Supreme Court this morning that I thought was good news and important to share.
Yeah, I just saw that not too long ago, but so back up a bit. Obviously, back last year, Trump got rid of the DACA order, and now since then, there's been an ongoing fight in Congress to try and replace it. It's not going great, but there was a separate lawsuit filed, and what's happened there, Rabia?
Yeah, there's been a couple of lawsuits. And also remember, we have a March 5th deadline coming up. And I don't know what Trump was planning to do on March 5th, like tweet angrily until it's dead. But anyway, so federal district judges in both New York and California had entered injunctions against basically what the administration, their ending of the DACA program. What the injunctions did was they said, no, the people who are already DACA applicants, they will be allowed to renew their applications. But the administration doesn't have to take any new applications, which is kind of a blow, by the way. But at least the people who are in the system are protected this way. So what happened was, you know, the administration asked, bypassing the normal route of, you know, from the district court, going to an appellate level, asking for cert, going to the Supreme. They just directly asked the Supreme Court to look at, you know, to look at this case and get involved in this. And they declined. That's what happened. This morning they said, nope, we're not going to do it. We're not getting involved in this issue. Michael, I don't know. Have you heard this news and have you been following these issues?
I've certainly been following it. I didn't catch the news today. So that's something that's a very interesting development, I'd say.
It's a good development. So yeah. Let's see how that plays out. I mean, like what can happen at this point is like the litigation can continue and the administration can continue to take the route they should have taken. It will take long enough to get through the appellate courts before it gets to the Supreme Court again that we're talking about maybe next term, not going to happen this term. So that gives a little more time also for Congress to work on this. And I'm glad at least the DACA recipients who are in the system will continue to renew their DACA applications, which mostly means they get to keep their work authorization, continue to live their lives. Although, you know, I'm sure many of them are planning exit strategies because you just never know.
And it makes sense. It's really unusual for the Supreme Court to sort of hear a fast-forwarded expedited plea like this in a case that's, I mean, despite the national importance, is a more standard case. So it doesn't even signal how they're going to rule ultimately on it, but it is a blow to the Trump administration. They can't, you know, hijack the system, fast-forward their case right now and get an immediate ruling.
you know, I'm wondering if maybe the court decided not to hear this because they're hoping that there'll be some congressional action and they'll sort of take it out of their hands and they won't have to decide this.
Yeah, well, it's not even it hope so much. It's just the normal process works for a reason. Well, that's the theory. So they're going to give a chance to do its job.
Right.
But that's a good point, too. I mean, like that, if they are able to come to some agreement, then certainly, I mean, there was no overwhelming reason for them to look at this other than Trump making his plea to the Supreme Court. And I don't know if in a case like this, like there's any, if it's ever reported, like which justices went which way, or it's just kind of a, the whole court says no, but that'd be interesting to take a look at. Of course, last week we talked a lot about the Parkland shooting and the fallout from Parkland continues. It's been interesting. CNN hosted a town hall last week. Did you guys watch it?
Parts of it.
I did not.
So it was a very lively town hall because these students did not hold back. You had a couple of politicians there. You had Marco Rubio, who got slammed pretty well because
I saw some of that.
That was a great clip. You had the student who said, I just want to know, just give me a yes or no. Are you going to stop taking money from the NRA? Just he kept repeating the question. And, you know, when I was watching that, I kept thinking, this is like what journalists keep failing to do with these people is they get sidetracked on an answer and then they won't keep pinning them down saying, no, give us an answer on this. So the student kept doing it. And finally, Marco Rubio was forced to say, no, I'm not going to stop taking their money because his reasoning was, I don't buy into their agenda. They buy into my agenda. Like, I believe this anyways. And so they're going to support me. That's fine. I'm not going to reject it. Got a lot of boos. Also, the NRA is losing a lot of corporate support. I think that's an interesting development. Has it not happened before? You guys following that?
Yes. I guess I feel this is a positive development, certainly, but I'm skeptical of how well there's how what kind of follow through there's going to be, because typically it's so difficult to sustain that sort of outrage, and I think outrage is the appropriate emotion here, but oftentimes it seems like these things are just don't have the kind of shelf life, and I'd really like to see this to, you know, certainly grow, but I don't know that it actually will.
You know, I feel like I understand what you're saying. I feel like the reason it might the momentum might stick is because of basically it's the students doing it at this point, right? You've got walkouts around across the country. You've got really angry students. This is also kind of for many of them, this is going to be a start in maybe an entire career of activism, right? One of the students tweeted, I think they tweeted or they said it, that we're going to outlive you to some congressman. And that's the thing. I mean, they're looking towards, many of them are probably either they can already vote or they will soon be ready to vote. And I think they will galvanize this in a way that hasn't been done before because the victims just weren't able to kind of have a solidarity in the same way.
I can't say I'm optimistic.
Yeah, I've just been burned too many times. I mean, we heard this after so many other mass shootings, and it just seems like there's this idea that the politics is really more organized combat behind the scenes. We talk about it sometimes in political science, and so much goes on that the public doesn't know about. So much with the NRA affecting how, you know, basically crippling the ATF and doing so many other things that never get reported on. And it's really this behind the scenes action, I feel, that's so crucial. And it's the kind of dull, boring regulatory stuff, and getting people to get worked up about that and sustain that is just so incredibly difficult. And I hope you're right, but the track record of, you know, of this is just not very encouraging.
But in terms of the NRA and its lobbying machine, it's possible there could be changes there in the future, because although it's still preliminary, we don't know what's going to happen there. There is an ongoing FBI investigation into possible NRA money laundering from Russia. They were a huge donor to Trump's campaign, more so than other presidents have in the past. And there have been questions raised about where that money came from. They have an arm that's not required to disclose its sort of source of the money. And yeah, we know that there's a longstanding relationship between several high-standing Russian officials or former Russian officials and NRA members, NRA leadership. And in fact, of course, there's at least two.
Haven't they held like conferences in Russia?
Yes. The same time that Flynn was over there in Russia for his RT gala, the NRA was there with, you know, Sheriff Clark and all that bunch.
Oh, just a coincidence. Nothing to see, right?
Well, we also know that at least two different NRA conferences, members of the Trump family have met with Alexander Torshin, the Russian oligarch who's got the huge NRA connections. Yeah. And of course, there were attempts to organize meetings between Trump and Putin's like high-ranking people during the 2016 NRA conference.
Do you think this connection with NRA and Russia is about money laundering versus something else? I mean, like, I don't understand what else, why the NRA would have any business at all in Russia, doing anything in Russia.
Because it's a wedge issue. The whole goal of Russia is to destabilize American democracy. And using the NRA to do that, it's a pretty effective tactic. And the NRA is more than happy to accept the Russians' help. It is a long game. They're doing that. And of course, I mean, there's a lot of affiliation between right-wing groups and particularly like right-wing white groups. Who sometimes see Russia as like the leadership of the white race because they're have predominantly white and non-immigrant populations still.
You know, Susan, there's a lot of people nowadays who are trying to start up their own businesses, working independently. And one of the most difficult things for people to do is find a professional space to meet potential clients. It's kind of really sad when you pop into a coffee shop to grab something and you see somebody you know, they are trying to hold a business meeting, and it's just not a good look.
Yeah, I'll go to coffee shops sometimes to work or, you know, read, catch up on emails, and it's great for that. But it's not a good place to meet someone to talk about something important, like business.
Well, that's what DaVinci's for, because they offer incredibly affordable meeting rooms in well-known office locations in almost every city in this country.
And with the DaVinci platform, finding the perfect meeting room is as easy as can be. You just search, book, and meet.
And whether you need a day office or a conference room, a boardroom or training space, I mean, they've got all kinds of spaces. DaVinci has a right room when you need it anywhere in the country. Once again, all you got to do is search, book, and meet.
Let's say you live in Phoenix, but you need to meet customers on a trip in New York or LA or somewhere in Nebraska. Skip the coffee meeting. Go to DaVinci, search, book, and meet, and get a meeting room instead.
And you know, all your DaVinci meeting rooms, they come with high-speed internet and the presentation tools to make your meetings successful. And it only starts at about $10 an hour. $10. Amazing.
Yeah. So go to DaVinciMeet.com/45 today. And for a limited time, get 50% off your first purchase. That's DaVinciMeet.com/45. Terms and conditions apply. See DaVinciMeet.com/45 for details.
Trump also met with some victims and community members, and he hatched a genius plan to keep students safe. So let's take a listen.
Your concept and your idea about it's called concealed carry. And it only works where you have people very adept at using firearms, of which you have many. And it would be teachers and coaches. If the coach had a firearm in his locker when he ran at this guy, that coach was very brave. Saved a lot of lives, I suspect. But if he had a firearm, he wouldn't have had a run. He would have shot, and that would have been the end of it. And this would only be, obviously, for people that are very adept at handling a gun. And it would be, it's called concealed carry, where a teacher would have a concealed gun on them. They'd go for special training, and they would be there, and you would no longer have a gun-free zone. Gun-free zone to a maniac, because they're all cowards. A gun-free zone is let's go in and let's attack, because bullets aren't coming back at us. And if you do this, and a lot of people are talking about it, and it's certainly a point that we'll discuss, but concealed carry for teachers and for people of talent, of that type of talent. So let's say you had 20% of your teaching force, because that's pretty much the number. And you said it, an attack has lasted on average about 3 minutes. It takes 5 to 8 minutes for responders, for the police to come in. So the attack is over. If you had a teacher who was adept at firearms, they could very well end the attack very quickly.
Here's my question. Have you, Michael, did you hear this clip? What are your thoughts on that?
I think this is a colossally dumb idea, I guess, to not put too fine a point on it. I mean, it seems like this is yet another example of President Trump having essentially no filter between his brain and his Twitter account and what he says. And also, the fact that he seems to be completely uninterested in doing anything but just spouting off whatever sounds potentially good to his base on the surface. I mean, if you do even a tiny amount of research on this and think about this, all the incredibly horrible unintended consequences, any reasonable person, I think, would realize that this is an awful idea. And the President of the United States, I think, has a special obligation to not be promulgating awful ideas. And yet, here we go again.
See, I wish I was confident it was just some idle tweet thought that he had, but this seems like a somewhat planned, like, policy position he's trying to adopt here and trying to push. They've given a thought. They've talked about funding. Yeah, no, it's like it's a real, to the extent that there's any kind of real policy in the White House these days, it's a real policy position they're adopting.
Well, yeah, I guess I differentiate between the White House and the president. I think the president's policies are whatever he happens to see on Fox and Friends or whoever the last person who talked to him was. Whereas the White House and the NRA and those other groups, certainly they're manipulating this incredibly easy to manipulate guy and using him as a way to ram through their agenda on a lot of issues. And I think this is another example of that.
I mean, there is, I have seen reporting that the administration is floating, I don't know, some kind of budget to arm teachers. I also read a couple of opinion pieces which said, you know what, like he said that, and then obviously, you know, news and social media was a Twitter, basically. People just lost it talking about it for a couple of days. And a couple of folks made the point that, you know what, it's exactly what you said, Michael. He's just kind of talking out of, you know, what end of his body,
yeah,
and ignore it. Like, you know, you should just not even take it seriously. It's so ridiculous. So much of what he says is ridiculous. It's not going to actually materialize. But then I'm reading reports that, okay, they're actually talking about funding. And for me, it's like, I don't know, like, should we be reacting to this? I mean, should we just ignore it and be like, okay, he's just crazy. He's like that crazy uncle at your dinner. You just listen and ignore it. Or is it something we should take seriously? I'm like, because you know what, if I think back to my high school days, there are a couple of teachers I can put my fingers on that be like, those would be the teachers who'd sign up. And they're the ones who shouldn't have the guns.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we have to take it seriously. Everything he said, I mean, we know on the one hand that he says a lot of stupid, crazy things, some of which he does not intend to ever do. But that's not a reason we can dismiss everything he says is like just Trump talk, because not all of it is. There's plenty of times he has said crazy sounding things and he's followed up on them. So although it's tiring and it's exhausting for the democratic process, you can't just ignore what the president says as a policy position in the hopes that, okay, he's just kidding this time.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I don't think he is kidding on this one. I think he's going to try and push it through.
Yeah, you know, this is not a conservative type of position at all. I mean, for the most part, these sort of decisions are made at the local level by school boards, and they don't want to do this at all. And yet here are these so-called conservatives wanting to push this national solution on all these individual low-level local units. And to me, it's just so incredibly hypocritical and not conservative at all.
Well, I do wonder if they would end up tying it to some other kind of funding for schools.
Sure.
That would, you know, force local schools, yeah, I mean, boards and stuff to be like, crap, should we take this seriously or not? Should we do this or not? But you're right. I mean, like, forget unintended consequences. I mean, I feel like any one of us could think of so many different scenarios that could go so, so tragically in a situation like this. And I certainly feel any teacher who is that teacher, who is the concealed carry. First of all, in a situation like this, I mean, like what actually happened at Parkland, there was, you know, an armed policeman or was it the sheriff himself?
Yes, armed sheriff.
Deputy.
Yeah,
and deputy.
Could do nothing, right? I mean, you've had attacks like on army bases and nobody can, and everybody's armed and nobody can do anything. I mean, like, it's just ridiculous. And I'm sure the teacher himself would be like target number one for some kid who wants to make his mark in this way. Well, oh, and to your point, you know, I was just thinking when you were saying that, Susan, you know, during the campaign when Trump kept talking about the wall, actually, I didn't take it seriously, to be honest. I thought he's just so crazy.
This is how he does it. He shifts the Overton window to the point where we're discussing it. And where at first you're like, okay, he's just talking. Let's not take it seriously. We're all going to be cool here. And then it enters the conversation. And at some point, it is a real policy position that's out there. Maybe not everyone's on board. Maybe it won't happen. But you're now debating it. It's like with his recent, like yesterday it came out. Oh my God, that he is apparently in private telling everyone that he wants to execute drug dealers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And this is the horror of this culture we have now, and that the President of the United States can seriously insist that he wants to find a way to execute nonviolent criminal offenders, and no one listens to it. It's like a minor news story on a minor day. I was like, whatever. He's probably not going to do that. But he's talking about it every day. He's changing the conversation. And we now have to consider that as a possible policy option that they may try and enact.
Man, that just kind of stopped me in my tracks. I completely missed that. But you're right. I can absolutely see Jeff Sessions lining up right behind him. And wow. Okay. Well, we also had a great gathering of conservatives in the past few days at CPAC. It's over now, I think, right? Trump was there. And he, again, brought up a bunch of stuff. But on the gun stuff, he sounded the... it's not even a dog whistle, but he sounded the alarm to the conservatives gathered. Don't get complacent. They will take away your Second Amendment.
Which is insane and no one actually believes. But now this is like a rallying cry he can use because he's gotten away with it often enough. It used to be like people would like angrily say, no, they're not trying to take away Second Amendment rights. He's lying. And now no one says anything because what's the point? He's just going to say the same stupid lie again.
You know, and that raises the question of what if we got rid of the Second Amendment? I mean, how relevant is the Second Amendment right now? I mean, Michael, what do you think about that? I mean, you are a political scientist.
I don't think it's so much about getting rid of the Second Amendment. I would argue it's more in terms of interpreting the Second Amendment in the conservative original understanding of the term, which a lot of conservatives don't seem to want to do. I mean, they like to really ignore that well-regulated militia part of it that's so incredibly inconvenient. So to me, it's just a matter of, and this is to me one of the main reasons why the Trump election was so dispiriting to me, is I thought we had an opportunity to get a majority on the Supreme Court that would start to make what I would consider some better interpretation of these things. And the Second Amendment is a great example. We don't need to get rid of it. We just need to go back to what the original intent of the framers was, and we'd be fine. But, you know, that's not the discussion we're having.
I understand. I guess, you know, I come from, you know, I was born in Pakistan. I come from a country where, like, nobody has a right to own, there's no constitutional right to own weapons, and people are just fine. It's always been a little confusing to me why this is such an important part of the American ethos and identity, just having a constitutional right to this, because so many countries don't, and people are okay. I don't get it. I'm just not going to get it, I guess. Well, did anybody watch any of the CPAC stuff or following any of it, you guys?
I've been following it, yeah. The Wayne LaPierre stuff just drove me absolutely nuts. That's sort of throwing red meat to the base thing. And really, it seems to me there's not a liberal equivalent to this. I'm not saying that, you know, people on the left don't do some of this, but just this organized gathering of inflammatory red meat sort of, it's just so incredibly destructive and just pains me to watch it.
What is the Duane LaPierre stuff?
Well, when he said essentially that, you know, people on the left don't care about children and they want to make us less free. And I thought, really? Well, you're either a fool or you're a knave if you say that. There's really no other option, because how can you possibly believe that if you've ever talked to any liberals? And if you're saying it and you don't believe it, well, then that makes you a bad person, I think. I don't see any other way.
I'm going with door number three here. I'm going to Susan, you were about to say something about CPAC.
Yeah, no, the LaPierre speech is an example of where conservative movement in America is heading in general. And it's also changed from his previous positions. The NRA did not used to be in favor of guns in school. They were against that. Not even like that long ago, less than 20 years ago. And it's, again, the NRA, its main position, main point is to make sure that maximize gun sales for the gun industry, which they have now amazingly found a way to turn a mass casualty incident into a way to sell guns by lobbying for all teachers or whatever percentage of teachers Trump wants today to have guns. So, but it's not just that. I mean, that is kind of their direct monetary financial goal. But in order to do that, they've had to turn this into not just a gun thing, but to a conservative movement thing. And I hate calling it conservative movement because that seems like a misnomer. But into this, let's call it what it is. It's like nationalistic, far right, ethno-state leaning sort of organization that promotes those values.
What do you guys think of the, you know, I mean, I've seen this floated a couple times and joked about it, too. Well, what do you think would happen if like large groups of American minorities said, okay, fine, we're just going to like enter this arena. We're going to join the NRA. We want our own caucus. We're going to take up arms as well. The theory is that would suddenly trigger, you know, the powers that be to be like, oh, wait a minute, maybe we do need tighter gun controls. Because the truth is, they don't want all Americans armed. They just want some Americans armed. But I'm guessing that if somebody like me went out and just put together an arsenal, a SWAT team would be here and kill me probably very quickly.
That's the Mulford Act in California. So the back in the day, the Black Panthers were marching, and in their protests, they would be armed. They'd carry, I'm not sure on the exact make of the right, but, you know, large, scary looking guns. And that was considered, you know, well, guess what? Maybe we shouldn't have open carry like this now. So that's when California enacted a bill that repealed whatever was allowing public people just to carry loaded firearms. And the NRA didn't oppose that. They were on board with it.
So it could actually work. It's time to mobilize the Muslims to get their guns.
But I think this explains really well why this has been a conservative movement tied in with kind of the white nationalism sort of thing that the NRA's, you know, sort of glommed onto, is because there are these, you know, this big group of people who used to be in charge and like things the way they were, when if you weren't a white male, you were sort of, you know, you weren't running things. And all of a sudden now they're threatened, and they understand that, and they know at some point they're going to be, I mean, you know, speaking as a white male, going to be the minority. And that's scary to a lot of them. And so it just, they play on those fears. And so it's a natural, beautiful, awful fit, I think.
Well, to talk a little bit about CPAC, which is a conservative, for those of our listeners who are not from the States, and we do have folks listening from outside the country. CPAC is the Conservative Political Action Conference. It's an annual conference that began in 1974, and it just so happened to begin during the Watergate scandal here with the Nixon presidency. And apparently during the conference, you know, the conservatives were actually kind of split in their support of or opposition to Nixon, which shows, I mean, it seems like there was less of a herd mentality at that time. And in that time, you know, Ronald Reagan of California, who was the governor of California at the time, he was a keynote speaker. He gave a great speech. He got a lot of prominence after that appearance. He also, interestingly enough, he introduced three former U.S. military prisoners of war in that speech, one of who was John McCain. And I bring that because one of the things Trump said in his speech just not too long ago was that he insulted John McCain once again at CPAC. I don't know if you guys caught that. And he attacked him because of the health reform vote, right? That's what happened, yeah. I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he read The Snake again. He's going back to all his best hits.
Right, he's going back to all his... Well, I mean, look, that's just where he's comfortable. I mean, like, he was like, he said, I love this place. I love you people. I wouldn't miss a chance to talk to my friends. These are my friends. He did the whole... I mean, there was even a brief lock her up chant that came out of the crowd. But, I you know, something happened to CPAC, like in the 90s and early 2000s, when their star was Ann Coulter. I think things got really, really toxic at that point, or I don't know, it preceded that. But it seemed like that was like the real steep descent, when people like Ann Coulter for years headlined this event. And in 2003, you know, she said, why shouldn't we go to war for oil? We need oil. In 2006, she said, I think our motto should be post 9/11, raghead talks tough, raghead faces consequences. We're talking about a national level conference in which the keynote, the headliner, is saying these things. And in 2007, she said, I was going to talk about the other Democratic candidate, John Edwards, but it turns out you have to go into rehab if you use the word faggot. We're not talking about 1945. We're talking about 2007, yeah, that this woman said, yeah, this.
The Trump moment is a scary departure from previous norms, but it was not born in 2016 or 2015. It's definitely accelerated in recent years, but these trends date back to, I mean, even before Coulter, but she was probably one of the early warning signs where we're headed, when she still maintained her position.
Yeah, I think I can see the beginnings of it really in the mid-90s with Newt Gingrich and the Republican takeover of Congress. I mean, there was a very clear and cleverly laid out plan for them to essentially take control by basically destroying credibility in government by saying and doing these outrageous things. And it was, you know, remarkably successful in gaining them power, but at what a huge cost. And we're still feeling the repercussions of that strategic decision, you know, to this day.
Since this has been ongoing, like you said, like 20 years, I mean, I don't know how long it's been. In a way, it surprises me that conservatives were shocked at the rise of Trump, that, you know, when he swept the primaries, that anybody would be shocked given this tone and this trend for the last 20 years. And how come conservatives didn't see it coming?
Because they thought they were exploiting this trend. They thought they were in charge of it. They could, you know, have Sarah Palin, that Sarah Palin could be the vice president, and they could throw the red meat out there to the base and rally it up without losing control of the party. they were very wrong about that, as Donald Trump showed them. But also they won. So they're like, okay, well, maybe this is how we who we are now. And
this is how we are now.
Yeah.
Well, Trump made his first appearance back in 2011. And this is what he said there. One of the things he said, our current president, who was Obama, came out of nowhere. In fact, I'll go a step further. The people that went to school with him never saw him. They don't know who he is. And then that same night, he went on Bill O'Reilly's show, and he said that he had investigators in Hawaii looking for Obama's birth certificate. I mean, so that's, I guess that's where that was born. But that's some pretty crazy crap. So anyhow, he's been obviously a darling of CPAC for a while now. This year, interestingly enough, CPAC expanded their umbrella to include the global far right. So Nigel Farage of the UK was there, Marine Le Pen.
Le Pen
of France.
So for everyone who says, I just want to back up for a bit. Anyone who says about the, you know, the current movement in America and where we're headed, that, and about any topic, would say that that can't happen here, whether you're talking about like the worst genocide or just more like authoritarian type state. Look where we were 3 years ago and look where we are now. We can have Trump giving a rally. There's locker up chants. There are far right leaders, white ethnostate promoters at the conference. And the party is supporting child molesters and sexual assaulters among its ranks and getting angry and booing off the stage a woman who stood up and tried to say, well, this is not cool. And look at just the emotion behind it. I mean, I'm not saying we're there yet. I'm not saying that tomorrow I'm going to wake up and live in like fascist America. But this trend shows how it can happen and how it's not being stopped yet.
And it's a trend all over Europe, too. I mean, like,
this is not just America. This is definitely a worldwide movement.
I used to think Europe is much scarier on these issues, but I take that back.
It was for a while. Like for a while, the sort of like dark white alt-right underbelly was more prominent. That's my impression anyway, in Europe than it was here. But here it's now a legit party with standing just like it is over in Europe.
Yeah. Well, they're in the White House. So, Susan, you know, as a mother, I have to take care of not just my nutritional needs, but also those of my family. And I'm always looking for high quality supplements that are not just like, you know, good for you, but you know, I gotta feed them to the kids. They also have to be like delicious. They have to be the kind that my family will take. And I want them to come from like great sources.
So what do you do for that?
Well, I turn to Ora Organic, because now when you are in supermarkets, you walk down the aisles, you can see a lot of, you know, products and organic stuff and organic potato chips. But that's where Ora Organic comes in, because they are actually organic, high quality supplements.
So how do you use Ora Organic?
Well, Ora Organic actually has a subscription service. So you don't have to keep running out and trying to buy it or buy it individually. You can just subscribe and they will deliver it to you automatically depending on the service that you decide to choose. It's free to cancel. They have a huge range of nutritional products. And when you do the subscription service, you actually get 20% off all of their products. And some of the products that we use in our family is we use their organic probiotic powder. We can add it to shakes and smoothies and even just like to juice, honestly. It tastes delicious and it helps with our digestion. We've got some of their vitamins. We have the vitamin D. I suffer from vitamin D deficiency. To be honest, I don't spend a lot of time under the sun. So they have these wonderful organic vitamin D supplements that we use. And we get them shipped right to us every so often because we have a subscription service.
So which will go if they want to sign up for this?
Well, to try Ora Organic with 15% off your first order, all you have to do is go to www.ora.organic and use the code 45th on checkout.
That's 45th at www.ora.organic.
All right, so let's move on to the other memo.
Well, before we do that, because again, a week is like a decade now, we had end of last week, before this weekend, a barrage of new developments in Mueller's investigation. You know, it was one of the craziest sort of like criminal procedure or onslaughts that I've ever seen play out in real time. And I do like, I'm an attorney, I work in DC, I do sort of white collar defense, so I see these kind of cases. I had no clue what was going on. Like, I check in every hour. I'm like, wait, there's three more indictments and there's an information and we're now over in Virginia with a new grand jury. Can you do that? I mean, yes, you can. I've just never seen it before.
Wait, so what's going on? Back up a bit. I don't know what's going on over the weekend.
This was not the weekend. It was last week.
Oh, you mean the Gates stuff?
No, the Manafort and Gates stuff. Yeah. So over a week ago, it's been like, what, 10 days back, there was the LA Times article that came out and said that Rick Gates, Manafort's partner, was going to plead guilty. At the time, I don't think that article was correct. It does not seem like that was actually the case. There was not a concrete plan to plea. We go into last week, go through Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. There's no plea. Nothing's happening there. And it doesn't seem like he actually intended to plea at that point. Then on Friday, Thursday and Friday, we just had everything happen at once. There were some sealed indictments, updated ones against Manafort and Gates. They were unsealed. New ones done. I still don't know the exact sequence of events that happened because it... For a bit, I thought they were switching. So the newest charges come from not from the existing grand jury in D.C., but an entirely new grand jury that no one seems to have known about at all over in Alexandria, Virginia. And by the way, not only is Mueller like the most amazing secret keeper, kudos to that grand jury for keeping it on lockdown, too. I don't know how he keeps a secret. This seems like unbelievably great OPSEC here. Like, there shouldn't be this many surprises. It's good thing there are, but you can tell that he has fantastic control over the information flow to the point where there's a new grand jury in Virginia and we didn't even know. What seems to have happened, and this is a bit reading between the lines, they had some of the new charges involved new banking fraud charges, and there was only venue that existed in Virginia. Now, in most cases, and like I would venture to say the overwhelming majority, although I don't know the stats back it up, you don't have two different proceedings going on in two courts because the defendant's going to say, okay, there's no venue for this one charge in this one court, but I don't want the massive expense of litigating two cases in two jurisdictions. So I'll waive venue and you can bring it over here to the same place the existing case is and we'll proceed that way. It seems like Manafort objected to the waiver of venue and these new charges, which means that Mueller had no choice but to bring in two jurisdictions. He wasn't trying to like bleed the defendants dry. He wasn't trying to like make their costs skyrocket. He was going to bring them both in D.C., but Manafort, for whatever reason, objected. I still don't know the logic behind that one.
And yeah, it's so much more complicated, right? I mean, to litigate it in two different jurisdictions.
Different different lawyers, different teams. You have to just when you have two different cases going on, it doesn't just double the work. It makes it more complicated. And then in the midst of all this, and so I started saving the files, and I'm like, Manafort indictment number... I have no idea because I just lost count and like just kind of put timestamps on them to try and track it out later. In the middle of this, an information is released. And so information is not so an indictment is when the grand jury comes back and says, yeah, we found a probable cause to indict so and so for so and so offense. Information is what happens often when you're going to have a plea deal. You don't have the grand jury do it. You issue the document. The plea is entered. And this happened for Gates. And Gates pled guilty to some relatively small charges, given what he was facing. Because the indictments released earlier that day had charges for sort of financial fraud and financial wrongdoing that would have meant they both die in prison. I mean, these would have been very, very long sentences. They would likely have, Manafort definitely would never have outlived it. And Gates, who's younger, I think he's in his 40s maybe, probably wouldn't have either. But the most remarkable part of Gates's plea is that he pled guilty to lying to the FBI in February of 2018, as in a few weeks ago. To give you an idea of where we're at, I don't know why he thought he could, like, wow, that's some hubris right there. Like, just a few weeks ago, he thought he could lie to the FBI about a conversation he had involving lobbying efforts. And of course, Putin senator Congressman Rohrabacher over in California about their efforts, you know, get their little Putin puppet in place in the Ukraine. And that seems to have been what triggered. I don't know if y'all saw the issues with Gates' attorneys past few weeks, where he has like a new attorney and they're trying to replace him, and his earlier attorneys are trying to get out of the case.
Oh God.
Yeah, my read of that is that from based on the dates, it seems very much like they knew the client lied, and they couldn't convince him not to lie, so they wanted to get out for their own ethical needs, and that's why there was all that sort of like back and forth going on back then. But given how quickly the lie seems to have been uncovered, it's very strange to think Manafort or Gates thought that he could get away with it. It's weird. Like, it's hard to keep track of this for me and other attorneys. Like, it's a very complex situation going on.
I mean, when you've got a Skadden Arps attorney lying to the FBI, I don't understand what's going on with anybody anymore. I mean, I don't know how anybody thinks they can get away with this.
Yeah, I mean, that was like sleazy as all get out what Skadden did, but it was more understandable because they were also like not the focus of a special counsel investigation with this much manpower and attention behind it. So I don't really have any answers or deep thoughts there. I am impressed with how it's going. I'm confused by how it's going. But what it does, it still seems to me like Mueller is doing, is he is making every single move on the board that he can make that is not directly a move against Trump and not directly a move against Trump's family. Until he exhausts every move he can make that's not directly against them, and then all hell is going to come unleashed out of the grand juries in Virginia and D.C. He is lining them up and knocking them down, and he is getting his whole set of witnesses together before he even publicly announces the charges he's trying to make. So, yeah, I guess in terms of timeline here, I think we're getting closer to the end. They want to interview Trump, so that's a good sign. They are almost at the end, but he's obviously not agreeing.
I wonder about that. I wonder about that, because if you take a look at the history of a lot of these investigations, I mean, it seems like Mueller's investigation is moving very rapidly from a historical perspective, and I would actually expect it to go on at least a few more years before we get to any conclusions. And I guess the other point I'd want to make is that it seems to me also that this is a great lesson in as to why you don't want to run a campaign with a bunch of amateurs, essentially, because a lot of the things that these people have done, even if you want to give them all the benefit of the doubt in the world, which I don't necessarily think they deserve, is they've done so many stupid, shady things that experienced campaign professionals would not do. And this is what you get when you have a bunch of amateurs running your campaign and running your government. They do dumb things. They do criminal things. They do criminally dumb things.
So I will say Manafort is a lot of things, but he is not an amateur. This is his wheelhouse. He gets incompetent wannabe dictators and fix their images.
Well, you're right. But in terms of presidential campaign running, in terms of running national campaigns, he's very new.
He's been
involved entirely.
In it.
Right. But he's kind of an outsider in that sense, I think.
I don't know. I think he's him and his colleagues and fellow businessmen in his group, like his various lobbying groups over the years, they've been involved in presidential campaigns from like Reagan onwards, even before Reagan. They've been in this game for a long time. Manafort took a break to go play in Europe for a bit. But this, whatever Manafort's doing, it's not out of lack of expertise. It's out of dedicated shadiness.
Right. But in this campaign, Manafort wasn't dealing with professionals. He was dealing with a bunch of amateurs who were not, you know what I mean? So it's not just Manafort. It was so many other moving parts, so many other people involved in, from Page to others who just mucked it. I mean, he's not dealing with professionals, even though he might have been one. And so maybe it was easier to keep some of it under wraps. But here's a question I have, though. I mean, even as Mueller is strategically like lining up all these people, couldn't Trump theoretically just pardon them as he goes along and just knock it all down? I mean, couldn't he just do that?
Theoretically, but the goal seems to have been to convince Trump that they're not actually coming for him. Not in so many words, but Trump is definitely, so far, he seems to have, like, taken the bait. After every new indictment, he's like, well, I was reassured that it was not about me. Like, look at the new, like, whatever. Look at the new Manafort stuff. It's not about me. It's sure the stuff happened during the campaign, but it's not about me. It's not about collusion. And he is buying into this line. When they had to brief him on the 16 charges last week against the IRA members and the people involved there, he went away happy, thinking that, okay, they're doing their job, but it's not going to come back to me. And the longer they can keep that going, the better. I think, however, at least, so I agree with you, this will go on for years, probably. This is not the end of the end. But in terms of the first stage, I think we're approaching the end, because why else, one, are they seeking to interview Trump unless they're looking to clean up and finalize one part of the investigation? But also, once Trump does get tipped off, he will take action and start pardoning. And I think that they'll have to move fast at that point. And I think the Kushner issue is going to force us to a head, because Kushner, I don't know if I can believe this, but it does seem like his attorneys really honestly didn't believe he was more than a witness in this case. From the statements they made and the way they've been posturing, it seems like, as unbelievable as it is, they may have thought that Kushner really wasn't a target. And they have learned recently that, oh yeah, he is, because he still does not have a security clearance. Can't get it. And 2 weeks ago, he's informed that, yeah, no, sorry, it's not going to happen. We can't tell you why, i.e. it's part of Mueller's investigation, but we've got something that means that, you know, Kushner, never are you going to get your security clearance through.
Well, he's also probably never going to be kicked out. I mean, Kelly apparently was like, he's going to make the final decision on it, but I don't think Kelly's getting rid of him, so it's still going to be around.
But with that hanging over their heads, they have to be getting a clue now that this is not going away, and in fact, this really is going to be at their doorstep sooner rather than later.
Well, I'm here for it. I'm here for it. All right. I mean, there's probably more. I feel like in the last couple of weeks, every day there's been more indictment news. So I'm sure that it'll keep coming this week, too.
The closer it gets, the faster I'll have to go.
Yeah. I had another thought that totally escaped my head. It was a question or something, and now I can't remember. Anyway, Michael, anything else you want to add to that conversation on?
No, I think, you know, I've been, you know, talking about this, obviously, myself, and that no collusion thing. I always want to add a yet, you know, I guess in the end, I wouldn't be surprised if President Trump isn't directly involved, but I would also be pretty unsurprised. I guess I'm expecting a lot of people close to the president to go down, because it sure does seem like that's where we're headed with this.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if he wasn't directly involved in some way, in the same way he's involved in everything he does, as the somewhat disinterested policy guy who sits on high and says, okay, go do this. He wouldn't care about the details, so he wouldn't have gotten involved with them anyway. But I'd be surprised if he didn't have knowledge in some degree of like, okay, go ahead and do that.
What about Pence? You think Pence did too?
I think Pence knew stuff. He's very too much cagey about what he knew and when he knew it.
Well, we have no indication that he is the subject of any of this.
No, not necessarily. Although he is kind of mixed up in the Flynn stuff. And also Manafort really wanted Pence to be the running mate, which raises a lot of questions in my mind.
About why?
Yes. So, and going back to the whole Manafort and Gates thing, we also had another kind of insignificant seeming development last week in regards to Flynn. Rabia, did you follow the Flynn conspiracy stuff going on over the past couple of weeks about how Flynn supposedly is about to withdraw his guilty plea?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Was that Twitter storm that you did? Was that in response to the courts? That was, okay. I very, very superficially, but go ahead and explain to listeners what's going on.
I mean, it's a ridiculous non-story in that they misconstrued a court order to decide it means that somehow Flynn's going to withdraw his guilty plea and be, like, exonerated. And that he lied when he said that he was guilty of the small crime that he admitted to.
The court order was just, like,
It doesn't mean anything.
Right.
But in terms of actual evidence of Flynn's intentions, what we learned last week is that Flynn has rejected any possibility of receiving the Trump Legal Defense Fund money. And that to me is huge. That's him affirmatively turning down what seems like his last chance to rejoin the Trump train. There is no going back for him. At this point, if he's not taking money, he's not trying to like boost his defense. He's not trying to mount a defense. He has chosen a path and he's committed to it. He has a son to protect. And also he has like charges that would be far worse than anything he's been charged with now. He doesn't want kidnapping on his record. So he has made a choice. And I think Gates has, too. I kind of wonder if some of the jockeying going on over is he going to plead, is he not going to plead, was over whether or not he would take defense money from the trust fund. Because these guys have money, they're not poor, but also this is super expensive what they're trying to do. So without the defense fund, it's pretty hard to effectively prove your innocence when there's so much evidence of your guilt. And I think that maybe he was considering taking defense fund money. And only after ruling that out did he decide to plead guilty.
You're talking about Gates.
Yeah. Sorry. And then now Manafort, of course, might hopefully try and tap into that sweet legal fund money. But we'll see.
Can he actually withdraw his plea at this point?
I mean, yeah, it's possible. There is a standard break me done. It can happen. But there's no reason to think it's going to happen here. So if you're on the East Coast or in D.C. like me, it seems like winter might already be over, which is good in some ways, but it means it's the end of waking up on a chilly winter morning and having a nice hot cup of coffee to start your day. And that's the best when it's Blue Bottle organic coffee.
That's right, because Blue Bottle coffee not only gives you delicious coffee, they deliver it right to your door, and it's incredibly fresh. They roast it and ship it to your house within 48 hours of placing your order.
So it always arrives at peak freshness. And just one sip of Blue Bottle coffee will make you realize that you've been doing coffee wrong your entire life.
By the way, I recently tried one of their coffees. It's called Bella Donovan. That's like the blend. It has notes of raspberry, chocolate, and molasses. Doesn't that sound amazing? It's amazing.
I need that one.
Yeah.
And not just is it good tasting, it's also good for the environment. Blue Bottle searches the planet far and wide to secure exclusive relationships with independent growers all over the world, and they source only the most delicious and sustainable coffee there is.
And you know what? They do have a lot of blends, like I mentioned before, but don't worry about what flavors you might want to try, because they actually have a coffee match quiz online, which is pretty cool, and it'll find the perfect coffee for your palate.
So go to bluebottlecoffee.com/45 for $10 off your first order. That's bluebottlecoffee.com/45. bluebottlecoffee.com/45.
So another bit of news that came actually over the weekend, which is interesting because it was released on Saturday, which is unusual, but
yeah,
weird, right? Very weird. But yes, so the Democrats' memo, which was the memo written in response to the Nunes memo, all about, you know, the dossier and the Carter Page warrants, the FISA applications and all that stuff. It was released on Saturday. This Saturday, I think in the afternoon, right before, actually, interestingly, Nunes was about to speak at CPAC. So it was a very, I don't know, interestingly timed release. I'm sure it was timed like that on purpose. But I don't know if you guys got a chance to read the memo. It's fairly well redacted, but there are some interesting key points there. What did you, Susan, did you read the memo?
I mean, if we were in a world that facts still mattered, this would be the end of the debate, but we're not.
What about you, Michael? Did you get a chance to look at it?
Yeah, I had a quick look, and it seemed to me that was exactly what we would have expected. And, you know, it just demonstrates, I think, that the Republicans basically cherry-picked a few facts and misled, and the Democrats wanted to get more information out, and they did. And it seems to me that it just, you know, it just strengthens their case that the only reason that the Republican memo was released in the first place, it wasn't about transparency or letting the public know. It was about trying to discredit the investigators, because I think they know they're getting close to something. And it's not that I don't think the members of Congress have any necessarily super close ties with President Trump, though some do, but they want to avoid the tsunami election that would happen if all of this stuff comes out. And, you know, I think they've taken lessons from Watergate and other things. And so they're trying to protect the president, to protect their own hides, and to just throw the FBI under the bus to do so. And I think that's, you know, reprehensible.
And don't forget, Nunes is, in fact, basically besties with Flynn.
That's
they
right.
They were
transition.
Super close. Mm-hmm. And former Flynn aides are now working for Nunes. Nunes was involved with Flynn after the election, all through the transition. And it's not impossible to believe he has more knowledge of what was going on than is publicly known yet. So his involvement is shady in a number of levels. He should have stayed recused. He didn't. God knows that if Paul Ryan had any kind of spine, he would stand up and get this guy off the HPSI. But he has not done that. And this is the shenanigans we have as a result. Now, the Nunes memo was nonsense. It was nothing. It was trying to discredit and takes. I mean, it didn't even make sense on its own terms, but even stuff it was trying to imply were just pointless. But the new memo shows just how much of a ridiculous farce the Nunes memo was. I mean, so the biggest complaint, I guess, if you had to choose like a number one greatest hit of the Nunes memo, it's the claim that in the applications for the FISA warrants, the government did not disclose that the Steele dossier was funded by Hillary Clinton and, you know, the DNC. And we now know that, no, those names were not in the dossier, but consistent with their procedures for how people are named in these applications, they did say that the Steele dossier was funded by a political source and the ultimate goal was to discredit the Trump investigation. Now, who do you think that could leave? Was it Jill Stein funding a massive effort to, like, research the Russian connections with Donald Trump? I don't think so. Maybe it was the Libertarian Party. Who knows? Who can say? But the idea that any judge, and by the way, we now know it was four Republican-appointed judges who made the four initial warrant application and then the three renewals, they knew absolutely who this came from, who funded it.
But right, that's what happens. I mean, they're getting desperate, and they have an entire media apparatus to make these ridiculous claims sound reasonable, because they're just presented in such a, you know, in such a slanted way. And so the truth doesn't even matter here if they just yell that this is, you know, that this is a partisan attack and the FBI is full of hacks. And that, by the way, Bob Mueller, who when he was appointed, right, many of these same Republicans were saying is this wonderful public servant, the model of integrity. And now he's just this awful guy out to get the president. I mean, it's insane. To me, at least. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it all goes back to sort of the model of, like, both sides reporting. I mean, if a major political party says something, that's the side they have to go with and report, and they have to treat it more or less equally to what the other side says, which can work, I guess, until you have one side that's plainly off the rails, and yet you're still having to present their arguments as if they were rational and had some connection to reality.
And Trump tweeted over the weekend, you know, Dem memo, FBI did not disclose who the clients were, the Clinton campaign, the DNC. Wow.
He didn't read this memo. Let's be real.
Well, exactly. He didn't read the memo either. But yeah, I mean, like, so this memo, I mean, it was dropped on a Saturday. I think it was because basically it just further harms the whole Nunes narrative, and they just didn't want it to make a splash. I mean, I don't think none of us were actually most people were not shocked with the Nunes memo. I mean, like, the buildup to it was like, and then the release, it was so anticlimactic. It's like, that was it. I mean, so
yeah,
I really didn't even sense a need for the release of this particular memo, because like you said, it kind of debunked itself. But I thought, one of the interesting things I thought in this memo was that there's a redacted portion where but it does say that the FBI had opened sub inquiries into a number of people associated with Trump. So sub inquiries to the Page inquiry. It doesn't have
not to the Page inquiry. Sub inquiries into the Russia investigation. So what we know is that there was an ongoing investigation into Russian interference, and then there were at least four sub inquiries into four members of the Trump campaign, and that was redacted. That section is not disclosed. It shows one name, Carter Page's, obviously, but the other three, well, even the number four was redacted, but they didn't do a good job of redacting, so you can tell that it's four people. And there's a footnote in that section that gives us a good hint of who might have been named there. And it seems like the four names and the four sub-inquiries that were existing before, as of September 2016, were Michael Flynn, George Papadopoulos, Paul Manafort, and Carter Page. And I find the Flynn one the most interesting, because it's possible that the sub-inquiry into Flynn had to do with his Turkey stuff, you know, and the fact that he'd already had meetings discussing the kidnapping of an American permanent resident to Turkey, which would be a pretty big deal on its own. But it, from the way it's written, I almost wonder if it's suggesting there was a sub-inquiry under the Russia investigation into Michael Flynn, which I wouldn't know how to explain this moment. I'm not sure what they would have been looking into or why he would have been on the radar for this, other than perhaps the 2015 RT gala that he had over in Moscow. So that's intriguing. And it does show that Manafort was also on the radar. But then again, we already knew that because they've been looking into him for years before for the Ukraine money laundering and lobbying issues there. We also learned, for instance, though, that Carter Page was recruited not once but twice before by the Russians. So we always knew, we've known for a while now, that in 2013, he was a target of Russian recruitment efforts, and that ended up being part of a plea deal that came out last year, or 2016. But now we now know, we don't know the date, that even before that, he was the target of Russian intelligence officers who wanted to, you know, make him an asset.
I read some reporting that said that they completely thought he was an idiot, but a
used
type one.
Oh, of course. So on the FISA warrants they used back then to get the intercepted communications between the Russians, they're like talking about Carter Page, and they're like, God, he's an idiot. But maybe we can use him and then fuck him by like not giving him what he wants. And that was in the counter memo, whatever counter we're on now, from the Republicans in response to the Schiff memo, saying that the FBI failed to disclose to the court that the Russians thought Carter Page was an idiot. Yeah, that was the flaw in this FISA memo. Yeah. Like, that changes everything now.
Susan, what do you think about the fact that the memo actually, the Schiff memo actually doesn't say anything about when Andrew McCabe told the House Intelligence Committee that no surveillance warrant would have been sought from the court without the Steele dossier information? It doesn't address that at all. And that's kind of a big selling point on like the importance of the dossier and the reliance on it.
I don't think we know what McCabe said. I think that it's clear that the Steele dossier was an important part of the Carter Page branch investigation, but it was not part of the other branches they had ongoing. And I don't think it doesn't matter. Like, what's the problem if this dossier tipped them off that a twice recruited Russian asset may have been recruited again? Like, it's not that hard to believe that they did it twice before and he's making suspicious trips to Moscow again. Maybe it happened this time too.
By the way, as we're having this conversation, Trump's tweeted a couple of times about this. Okay. Well, Trump actually just retweeted a Fox News tweet, which it's just so ridiculous. I guess Trump was on the phone with Fox News.
God.
And over the phone, he said, they actually spelled the quote out as if it's so profound in their tweet. So Fox News tweets, President Trump on Dem FISA memo. A lot of bad things happened on the other side, not on this side, but the other side. And somebody should look into it because what they did was really fraudulent.
He followed that up by saying, and by somebody, you know who.
You know who.
That's how the president of the United States refers to his attorney general.
Yeah.
So that, oh my gosh, that entire interview was insane. If you want to like lose all faith in the Republic and our hopes for the future, watch it, because I was despairing after that guy. I mean, Trump is obviously an erratic kind of human being, but the Trump that was on the phone with Judge Pirro, whatever, he sounded manic. He sounded off his rocker. He was all over the place, incoherent, aggressive, spinning in circles. And it's not hard to imagine that man making an extremely impulsive decision at the wrong time and causing ungod-known amounts of just terror and pain and war. Because he was that impulsive seeming.
Oh, yeah.
She was trying to stop him. Oh, my God. When he started ranting, she'd be like trying to like, Trump, like, let's turn the subject. And he would just bulldoze her and keep rambling forever. Ugh. One more point on the counter memo. The newest Democratic memo on this whole Carter Page affair. Now, it was still redacted in large and significant parts. Most of it's not redacted. It's actually less redacted than I was fearing. But, of course, the really interesting things are redacted. And what those, in large part, have to do about are the renewals and what was in them. And what the redactions make clear, although they don't say what it is that in conducting surveillance on Carter Page, they found something that was important and useful and resulted in the renewal happening three different times. So whatever happened post-October 21st application for the first FISA warrant, they listened in on Carter Page and they found stuff that was important. They learned something that they would cite in the future renewal applications that says, for instance, we have in subsequent FISA renewals, DOJ provided additional information obtained through multiple independent sources that corroborated Steele's reporting. They are, and we've got, let's see, four bullet points. First bullet point, totally redacted. Second bullet point, totally redacted. Third bullet point, pages, redacted, in Moscow with, redacted. Senior Russian officials, redacted, as well as meetings with Russian officials, redacted.
That's a lot of redacted.
Yeah, but it gives you an idea that, like, after October 21st, they learned about some kind of meetings that Page was having in Moscow. Now, it could have been the July 2016 meetings that were referenced in the Steele dossier, or it could have been meetings that happened during his second trip in 2016 to Moscow in December, or his random trip to, like, Budapest in September 2016 that we still don't understand why the hell he did that, when he says he might have possibly run into a Russian in the hallway or something.
Maybe, kind of, maybe. Might, sort of. I'm taking bets on when he's finally going to lawyer up.
At this point, he's found his peace. He's found his bliss. He's just going to roll with it. He's on his own journey.
You know, and I have this weird feeling that he's going to be the one who, like, doesn't get charged with anything. He's just,
oh my God.
He's just somehow going to escape charges because everybody thinks he's an idiot. And he's just, but he will be the key to unlocking a lot of other really important.
This movie, the final scene, it's all going to end. It's going to pan out to a beach, some, like, you know, exotic island somewhere, unidentifiable. And it's going to zoom in on two figures sitting in, like, the little, like, beach lawn chairs with margaritas clinking their glasses together. And it's Carter Page and Felix Sater.
I thought you were going to say Mueller.
You know, I think the tragedy, though, of all this is if you look at what regular people are probably thinking about this, is they're confused, they're doubtful, they think that, who knows, the FBI might be corrupt, the FISA court might be corrupt, and you know, this is the kind of loss in credibility that is going to take a long time to regain. This is going to be well past the Trump presidency. I mean, there's the damage that Donald Trump and his band of incompetents and reprehensibles are doing right now. But this is the kind of thing that's going to echo and have repercussions for a very long time, no matter who the next president is. And that's the thing that really concerns me, this cavalier attitude of, well, we'll go for a quick political win right now, and who the hell cares that we've just destroyed credibility in this institution? That, to me, is just stunning.
Yeah. No, this is not going to be fixed in our lifetimes.
No, no. Don't mean to be a big downer, but that just really bothers me. Yeah.
No, it's true. I mean, like, I think that's one of the most damaging things about this presidency is whether it's the media, whether it's the judiciary, whatever it is, any institution that Trump doesn't happen to be happy with that moment becomes a target. And I think one of the most shocking things in the last couple of weeks also is him. I mean, they've been going after the FBI, but also doing it in connection to the Parkland shooting as well.
Yeah.
But again, they've committed to this path and nobody seems to be stopping them. Nobody in GOP leadership either. And that's a real shame. So, all right. So I think that's it for this week's episode. Anything else, Susan? Or are we all done? Anything?
For now, I'm sure in an hour or so we'll have new indictments from Mueller that we'll discuss next week.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this week, Michael. Once again, I want to tell our listeners to please tune into the Politics Guys podcast. Can you tell our audience where they can find you online?
Sure, where you can find us through the usual places, iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, but also online. We're at politicsguys.com.
Are you on Twitter, social media?
Oh, yeah, we're on Twitter. We're at Politics Guys, and our Facebook page is Politics Guys page on Facebook. So, yeah, we're everywhere pretty much.
Awesome. Wonderful. Thank you so much. And I will be tuning in, and I hope our listeners do as well. And all right, Susan, I'll talk to you in about a week. I'll be out of the country. Next week, you're on your own.
This will be the week, then, that it happens. It all happens. And you're not going to be here for it. It's going to be this week that Mueller chooses to bring down his whole avalanche of indictments. And
it'll be this week. And I also think this will be this week that we get a ruling in.
Oh, God. That's my biggest fear. That's going to happen, you know. They're going to time it to be as annoying as possible for us.
I'm going to be in the air when this happens. A lot's going to happen. But you know what? As long as it happens in a way that I want it to happen, I don't really care about that. So, all right, guys, have a good week. And thank you so much.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.